We're discussing today the duty to save lives in Jewish law, Jewish ethics. And Jewish law, Jewish ethics, that's basically a key point we need to understand. If we consider for a moment secular law, modern American law, Western law, other jurisdictions, in the U.S., there is generally no duty to rescue. You can see somebody dying in the street, you can just walk on. Doesn't mean you're morally justified, obviously, but legally, you generally have no duty to do anything. We are familiar with mandated reporters. The law has decided over the last four decades or so that there are certain professions have the duty to report certain types of crimes, typically against vulnerable people, psychologists, doctors, maybe teachers, people who are in professional and contact with vulnerable groups, elderly people, children, vulnerable people of other sorts. The law has established mandated reporting. But again, that's a fairly recent innovation, and it's very limited. Only certain people are defined as mandated reporters. In general, if you're a simple bystander or you're a construction worker, you have no duty to, no legal duty, of course. There's a moral duty, maybe, but there's certainly no legal duty to step in. Now, some countries apparently do have a duty to rescue. Some European countries, other countries, some have a fairly broad duty to rescue, some less so. But the U.S., you know, the jurisdictions we're used to generally don't. I saw Wikipedia tells us that some states have established various duties to rescue, but again, they're not you know, that deeply embedded in the legal fabric. You don't hear about cases of people being sued and fined and thrown into jail for callously driving by the scene of an accident and refusing to stop and offer assistance. In general, there is no duty to rescue. There is no legal duty to rescue. Even here, the law does have apparently certain specific cases in which you have a duty to rescue. A spouse apparently has a duty to rescue. I don't know if this ever goes to trial, but a duty to rescue a spouse, a parent, child. There are certain cases where you have implicit contractual obligations to rescue, an employer to an employee maybe. But barring certain specific relationships, arbitrary bystanders typically have no duty to rescue, no legal duty, and then the question becomes a moral duty, which is obviously not a legal question, analyzed through a whole different set of everyone is free to pick his own moral code and their own principles and so on, a totally separate thing. In Jewish law, Jewish thought in general, a major theme is that we don't have this bright line distinction between law and ethics. There's a great deal of stuff in the Talmud, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the great legal codes that incorporates quite a lot of material that our Western system, for example, would relegate to the domain of ethics. We have many halachas that many laws that are in the same Shulchan Aruch, the same codes of Jewish law, they seamlessly flow from things that are typically within the domain of law into the domain of ethics. I always like to quote Dr. Nachum Rockover, a leading Jewish law expert in Israel, was once asked in an interview how he does a lot of comparative law, comparing Jewish law to modern systems of law, and they asked him, interviewer asked him, how would you define the uniqueness, the singular aspect of Jewish law? And he made this point. He says the law has its legal rules, common law, statutory law, and so on. But the law is the law. Beyond that, we simply shove that off into ethics, professional ethics, personal ethics, or whatever. Jewish law is not like that. Jewish law integrates a lot of what we would see as ethics into the law. And this is a classic example. The duty to rescue in Jewish law, while in a certain sense it is different from a question of plaintiff and defendant, it's a halacha, just as Jews, it's almost like ritual law, just as Jews beyond civil law were commanded to keep Shabbos and keep kosher and stuff like that, we're also commanded to render assistance. So the title of our talk today is to save lives. In general, there is a duty, there is an obligation also even to save property, to render assistance that's short of life-saving. As we'll see, it's kind of an extension of the laws of Ashav Saveda, the laws of returning lost property. And the fact that it's another point on the same spectrum, on the same continuum of returning property and helping your fellow Jew in general is going to have significant ramifications when we discuss the nature of this obligation, the parameters, when it applies, and perhaps certain exceptions to the general obligation. So the core Talmudic passage, we'll consider some of the core primary sources within Jewish law for this obligation. The core Talmudic passage discusses the very dramatic case. Someone's drowning, someone's being dragged away by an animal. We have the case in the flyer of the fire. It's all the same idea. Whether he's being attacked by bandits, doesn't matter who or what the aggressor is, who or what the danger is. Someone, a Jew, is in danger of his life. How do you know that you have an obligation to save him? The Torah says, "Lo samar al dam re'echa," you shall not stand by idly while your brother's blood is being spilled, while he's in danger of his life. You have a Torah obligation to step in and do what you can to provide aid. The Talmud asks that we have another source. The source is Hashemes Aveda, the mitzvah, the commandment to return lost property. You see somebody drop his wallet, drop his pen, you have to get up and return it to him. Again, modern American law typically does not require that. You can't pick up the wallet and keep it for yourself, but you have no obligation to bother to retrieve it and turn it into anywhere. You don't have to even call out to the guy that he just dropped his wallet generally. But Jewish law, of course, does have such an obligation, the obligation of Hashemes Aveda. The Talmud says that should certainly imply a fortiori. If you have an obligation to preserve and save his property, return his property, you certainly should have an obligation to preserve and save his person. So the Talmud says, you're right. The obligation to save lives is indeed derivable, is indeed an extension of the duty to save property, to return property. And the reason you need a second verse of Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa, by not standing by while blood is being spilled, it says we derive an extension of the obligation. We derive the fact that you're not simply obligated to save him if you can do it personally. You're even obligated to retain help, to hire help if you can, if necessary, if that's the way you can save him. If you can't swim, you have to call someone else who can. You have to call an ambulance, call the police. Those are examples of calling someone who will do it for free, but you even have to hire people. You even have to hire, do whatever it takes to save somebody who is in danger. Now, incidentally, when it comes to Hashemes Aveda, I've been interchanging the terms return lost property, save property of a Jew. The general Hashemes Aveda obligation encompasses both. Classic Hashemes Aveda you learn about in school, you learn when you study Talmud, is somebody lost something, he lost his wallet, lost his pen, you find it, you have to return it. A similar obligation applies to save his property from danger. If you see his house is caught on fire and you can put it out, you have an obligation to put out the fire, and so on and so forth. The obligation is both to preserve and save his property as well as to return it. If he has lost it, the Talmud extends that to saving lives. The Talmud even extends that to requiring you to hire people, if necessary, to save the life. The Talmud actually is not entirely clear when it says you have to make the effort to hire assistance, whether you have to do that out of your own pocket or not. The general consensus of halakhic authorities means out of your own pocket. You have to write the check. You have to pay the aid workers if necessary. There was a suggestion by the Chavos Yar, by Yar Chaim Bacharach, that you don't have to spend money out of your own pocket. It means you have to make arrangements, but you can have them bill the victim. You don't actually have to spend any money, but the dominant view is that you do have to spend money. You are allowed to send the bill to the victim. If you call an ambulance for him, a private ambulance that's going to charge, you are allowed to say, even if you lay out the money up front, you're allowed to tell the victim, I just spent a lot of money to save your life. You are obligated to reimburse me. That's fine. Since you spent the money to save him, he does have a legal halakhic obligation to reimburse you. But the general consensus of halakhic authorities is that you do have to lay out the money, and we'll discuss this more soon, and that you have to lay out the money even if you have limited or no expectation of being reimbursed. You know, he doesn't have the money. That's the consensus. Not everyone agrees, perhaps surprisingly, but the general consensus is that you have to spend money even if you have no hope of being compensated. Now, again, you can bill. You are allowed to bill, and in many cases, you will get the money back. But the consensus view is that you have to spend the money even if he will not be able to reimburse you. Now, there is a very strange position taken by, maybe not so strange, but a very striking position taken by Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, a leading 19th century Russian halachist. He argued, he took this Talmudic passage at face value, that the obligation to save lives is a simple extension, incremental extension of the obligation to save property. And he therefore argued that the general limitations and qualifications on the duty to save property should generally be extended to the duty to save lives. For example, the specific case he talked about, let's say the Talmud has a case called Zaken Veino Lefi Chvodo. It's beneath your dignity to be seen hauling some package through the streets. You're a Talmud Chacham, or perhaps even, according to some, you're a dignified citizen. You're one of the town's leading citizens. Today, you know, we care less about this kind of personal dignity. Back then, you know, there were appearances, and there was the way you dressed, and the way you carried yourselves. A lot of things were considered uncivilized, undignified. to be, you know, hauling and schlepping and doing things like that on the streets. Talmud says, in such a case, you are not obligated in a Shavas Aveda. You don't have to return lost property because the preservation of your dignity takes precedence to returning someone else's property. Says Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, the same thing applies to saving a life. If you would look ridiculous or silly, stripping, I guess, your underwear, for example, and jumping into a river to save somebody's life, then you don't have to do it. You can let him drown. Now, most halakhic authorities react in much the same way that you all just did. They say that, you know, even without being necessarily being able to make the argument in terms of all the rigorous and technical considerations, we know that the Torah's values, paramount value of life, we violate almost any mitzvah in the Torah to save life, we violate the Shabbos, we drive on Shabbos, we eat non-kosher food, we eat on Yom Kippur, we do pretty much any avera you can think of is set aside and is overridden by the need to save lives. How can it be that mere, you know, personal dignity is could be considered, and we're not even talking about, you know, depersonal humiliation, we're not talking about everyone understands it's a noble thing to do. You're a hero if you rescue the guy. We're not even talking about, you know, serious, long-term personal degradation. So Rabbi Kluger's position is indeed counterintuitive, to say the least, and is generally rejected by most later authorities. So there are various ways of phrasing the technical counterargument. One of them is, some Moshe Feinstein and others point out, that the halacha is you're only exempt from returning lost property to preserve your dignity if that was the decision that you would make if it was your own property on the line. So Rabbi Feinstein and others say if it was your own child on the line, if your life was on the line, you wouldn't be so concerned about dignity, so you shouldn't be holding those standards up when it comes to someone else's life on the line. So in general, Rabbi Shlomo Kluger's position is not normative. He himself walks it back a little bit at the end. But what it does is it illustrates the extent to which various poskim have seen the duty to save lives as a very incremental and very straightforward extension of the duty to return lost property. There is a similar...
Is he perhaps supported by the fact that the Gemara asks, you didn't need a pasuk of L'Savra L'Avriyecha, right? It doesn't answer well. There are certain things you wouldn't have learned from...
Yes, the point Rabbi Schwartz is making, the technical argument, is exactly Rabbi Shlomo Kluger's source. I wasn't going to get into the details of his technical argument, but that essentially is his point, slightly more rigorously, the point I was making before. The fact that the Talmud implies that there's really very little difference between what we derive from Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by your brother's blood, and what we derive from Hashavas Aveda, implies that there really isn't a whole lot of difference in practical application, other than the one the Gemara itself gives. That's exactly his point, and other authorities, because he has other proofs, that's one of his main proofs, and then other authorities debate that. They counter that argument, but yes, that's exactly his argument.
Sorry, just to be clear, the Hashavat Aveda comes out of this pasuk from Vayikra, or it comes out of returning lost property?
Returning lost property.
Okay, that's where Hashavat... Okay,
yes.
So what...
The Talmud was asking that, why do you even need a verse that tells you don't stand idly by in Vayikra? You can anyway extrapolate that from Hashavas Aveda, which we know from other psukim.
Okay.
The Talmud derives this additional level of hiring workers. A similar argument appears about the question of a suicide, someone who deliberately tries to end his life. Do you have a duty to rescue, a duty to save the life, if you can, of someone who is committing suicide? Now, obviously, in a practical situation, we would probably say there would be various practical reasons why you should. We would say he's disturbed, he isn't acting rationally. And the truth is, halakha itself recognizes this. While in the very early halakhic sources, there's very sharp censure and halakhic negative consequences for a suicide, for the way we treat him afterward, the way we remember him. We often don't apply these rules today because there's a general presumption that people who are driven to that point are often mentally troubled, and we don't hold them completely liable for their actions. But in principle, at least, if someone was a deliberate suicide without any degree of mental disturbance and so on, so the Minchas Chinuch, another 18th century, 19th century source, says that there would be no duty to save a suicide, even if one could, because again, just as with regard to Hashavas Aveda, the rule is if someone deliberately chooses to leave his property lying around in an unsafe and insecure location, then he can't then expect you to take care of his property. If you make the decision that you're not interested, I don't have to, the Torah doesn't expect me to be more solicitous of your property than you are yourself, than the owner is himself. Michas Chinuch actually extends this point to saving lives. He suggests that you would have no additional obligation to save somebody's life if he doesn't care about his life himself. Again, this point is generally rejected by other authorities. They argue, despite the fact that, again, the Talmud seems to be implying that the duty to save lives is simply an extension and a slight incremental extension of the duty to return property, the normative halachic view is not like that. We often invoke the idea that a person's life is not really his own. A person has obligations to God with regard to his life. It's not up to you to make all decisions about your life. Some decisions, not all. You do have a responsibility to God. And in general, the halacha is, despite the fact that the Talmud implies that it's no more than a Shavas Aveda, in practice, the consensus view is that, no, it is a significantly broader obligation. You do have the obligation to rescue someone, even if he is trying to destroy his own life. And that is the general consensus. Now,
you can also argue that Shabbos Aveda for the family. If somebody is taken away from his spouse, kids, whatever, and they want him back, so you're actually...
That's an interesting point. That the suggestion is that you have a duty to the family, maybe to the community in some cases, children certainly. An interesting argument. I don't recall seeing anybody make it, but that's certainly an interesting argument. I like to tell the story. There's a halacha that in general a person is expected to buy Jewish when he can. If the prices are equivalent, a person has a brotherly obligation to patronize Jewish vendors, sell to Jewish people when possible. So there's some debate about how that applies to those who have cut themselves off from the Jewish community and are not Jews in good standing. So there's a story about the Chabina Rav, a great Haredi leader in Israel half a century ago. He was once asked about someone who was an industrialist, had a factory in an area where the labor force were not religious, were not members of the religious community. He was considering relocating his factory to, I think, Bnei Brak, an area where his workforce would then be no teleworking here. The workforce would be local and the workers would then be Haredi. And is this a good idea? Shmina Rav said, nope, he's not endorsing it. He said, even if we're going to argue that observant Haredi workers should have some preference over non-observant, non-Haredi workers, that these kids have little children, he said. The little children are blameless and innocent, he said. I'm not going to sign off on a plan to take Parnassa away from innocent children who are in no way to blame for any decisions made by their family. So that's the same point you're making, that there might be a broader obligation to the family than the person himself, and that's certainly an interesting point, although I don't remember seeing anybody specifically making it in this context, but it's certainly possible. Now, in terms of the scope, in terms of how far do you have to go to save lives? So we've seen the Gemara says if you can't do it personally, you have to hire somebody else. Mentioned earlier, most authorities say that that's true, even if you have to lay out the money, even if you won't be able to get it back. The minority view not like that, but the consensus is you have to spend the money. We discussed on a previous occasion, we discussed in the context of organ donation, do you have to risk your life? You know, let's say, again, the case of someone drowning or the burning building. If you go in, you may be successful and both of you may come out alive. You may not be successful. You may die and might not even accomplish saving the person. On the other hand, if you don't do anything, he's facing certain death. Do you have, what is your responsibility in such a case? This is actually the subject of considerable controversy. There is a view that you should risk your life to save someone from certain death. The consensus view is that you do not have to, and that you shouldn't, and that you are actually, the halacha says that your life takes precedence. You should not assume significant risk even to save somebody else from certain death. The question is how much risk. You know, there's a counter position taken by some authorities that if the risk is really minimal, you shouldn't be overly protective of yourself. You should be willing to assume some small levels of risk. And again, exactly how much risk is a subject of considerable dispute, but the consensus view is that major risk is significant. 50% level risk is certainly not appropriate. Very minor risk probably is. When we discussed organ transplants, that's the general calculus. That's the general lens through which the halacha views the, let's say, donating a kidney. There is some risk to the donor. It's small, but general anesthesia, it could be 1 in 10,000 mortality. The people they choose are typically healthy, so the risk is low. But there's small risk. But there, the postmortem have generally said that you have a right, if not necessarily a duty, to take that level of risk because it's quite low. But in general, the rule is that we don't even want you to assume significant levels of risk to save somebody else. From even if it's a question of certain death. Now, we mentioned earlier that there is some debate about even whether personal dignity takes precedence over saving a life. General consensus is that it does not. There is, however, a very curious debate, and this is actually a debate that has survived for hundreds of years without absolute resolution. Let's consider the question from the, flip the question around. Can a person steal, infringe on another's property rights or another's dignity to save his own life? I'm trying to get away from someone chasing me or from some other fatal type of misfortune. The way I want to do that is by destroying someone else's property without his permission. He's not around to ask him, let's say, or he doesn't want to cooperate with me. Do I have the right to do that to save my own life? So in the one sense, we can look at this as kind of an extension of saving lives. If he has an obligation to spend money to save my life, then I presumably should have the right to take his property to save my life by the same logic. But here we find a surprising amount of dispute on this very question. There are a number of Talmudic references to this, but the debate primarily begins around the 18th century, the 18th, 19th century. The question had to do with autopsies. The question that arose was, we want to dissect a cadaver in order to learn more about the disease that killed him, which will benefit medical science in general, which may even have a more immediate, short-term benefit for saving lives of other people who might be suffering the same disease as the person who just died. Are we allowed to do that? So the framework of the question is that Nivul Hames, disrespecting the human remains, is generally a prohibition. And it's considered both an offense against God as well as a personal offense. It's considered the person is no longer alive, but it's still considered in some sense a personal offense against the dignity of the departed. So the question is, do I have the right, I can't ask him, he's dead, do I have the right to take him apart to learn about what killed him in order to benefit humanity in general, specific people who are suffering the same disease? This was a debate among a number of the leading 18th and 19th century scholars. The general consensus, Nodi Behuda, Rabbi Chazkel Landau, as well as Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, the general consensus distinguishes between the two cases of whether we're simply out to benefit medical science in general, or whether we have concrete benefit that we hope to deliver for patients who are currently sick right now. In the latter case, we apply the rule that Bikuach Nefesh, the value of saving lives, overrides pretty much everything else, all other mitzvahs, even Shabbos and Yom Kippur and so on, as we said before. So autopsy is not worse than those. If you're actually going to save another patient's life, you even have a hope of saving, it doesn't have to be a certainty, even a chance, even less than 50% chance of saving someone else's life, you do it, you do whatever you have to do to the remains of the departed. But for the benefit of medical science going forward in the future, that is more tenuous, it's longer term, you don't have the actual situation of pikuach nefesh, of danger to human life, present right now, even if you can argue statistically it will benefit some human at some point. That, the halacha says, is generally too tenuous a connection to the sin you want to commit right now. Poskim have not generally allowed this. This basic kind of logic appears in a variety of areas in Jewish law. We're very reluctant to allow flat-out, straightforward violation of halachic law today, even if we can argue that it'll provide a general benefit to society going forward. So, for example, I spoke about this yesterday, the question of kohanim, Jewish priests going to medical school to learn to become doctors, where they have to study gross anatomy, which is typically done in the U.S. at least, by hands-on work on cadavers. So again, the question is, the Kohen is going to have to, we read about it in this week's parasha, the Kohen is going to have to become Tameh now, and hopefully if he learns to be a doctor and becomes good at what he does, he can save lives going forward. So the question is Pikuach Nefesh, the duty to save lives, the mitzvah of saving lives, the value of saving lives, is that sufficient reason to allow the Kohen to set aside the prohibitions on Tumas Meis, on becoming defiled from human remains? The strong consensus of most halakhic authorities is no, it is not a sufficient reason. Some poskim allowed it for a variety of other technical reasons out beyond the scope of today's talk, but there is a minority opinion that did argue pikuach nefesh. Having medical practitioners in the world is a matter of pikuach nefesh, even though the several years it'll take you from your basic anatomy class until you're actually out there saving lives, There isn't an actual patient sitting here right now who you say, just wait here for 3 years, I'll get my license, I'll be board certified, I'll come back and I'll save you. That isn't really the situation. But nevertheless, there was a minority view that considered that pikuach nefesh and allowed doctors to train, but the very strong consensus led by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was that that is too tenuous. Rabbi Feinstein made two counter-arguments to this claim. First, he said, thank God you're not the only doctor in the world. Other people are serving as doctors. Other people are training. If Kohanim don't train, the world will not lack doctors. Second, he made this argument we've been making, that the connection between the Avera, the sin I want to do today, and the long-term benefit is too tenuous, it's too far in the future. We don't allow wholesale violations of Pikuach Nefesh. We don't allow wholesale violations of Avera today in the hope that somewhere down the line you'll provide some benefit to human society, to human lives. And that was the basic point made by the Chasam Sofer and the Rebbe Yehuda, that we're not going to allow autopsies, even though they benefit medical science, because the connection to saving lives is too tenuous. Again, it probably is a good idea to take into account the historical context. Medical science was far less advanced than it was today. It was probably much harder to draw. Many of the doctors were doing probably more harm than good, and it was probably much harder to show a clear line between 18th century scientists messing around with cadavers and actual human lives being saved. Today, where we have a medical establishment which clearly saves millions of lives, and it's clearly understood that basic research and basic training is necessary for advancement in medical science, you could certainly make a much stronger case for the necessity of doing this. But even today, I don't think posts can generally allow the donation of Jewish cadavers for science. Donate your brain to science, and posts don't generally allow that, despite the fact, again, possibly at least in part because of the other point of Rabbi Feinstein, that they anyway have other materials they can work on. It isn't quite as essential for you to give your part, so we look at it kind of from the macro, micro perspective rather than the macro one. But most postkim held that, again, the future general benefit is not tight and rigorous enough to be considered a justification under the duty to save to violate halacha. But they did allow, if there was a chola b'faneinu, if there was someone sick right here who you had a hope to save by opening someone else up, that Rabbi Sofer and Rabbi Landau allowed. There was one holdout, and that was Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger, the author of the Binyan Sion, another leading scholar of that time. He said no. He argued at great length, even to save somebody's life, we will not allow you to dissect someone else's remains. He made the very bold, very provocative argument that when Hashem tells you that you can violate any Avera, God says, do any sin that you need to do in order to save lives, set aside Shabbos, set aside Yom Kippur, set aside the dietary restrictions. Those are, so to speak, the mitzvahs between a person and God. God says, you're all my children, I waive almost all my prohibitions for you to save lives. Anytime you infringe on another human being, someone else who has rights, then God says, I'm not waiving that. You have a duty to your fellow man. I am not waiving any obligations that you have to your fellow man, any rights that he has to his property or to his dignity, and you have no right even to commit simple theft to save lives. And the source of this position is rooted in a interesting and somewhat colorful Talmudic passage. It's an Agadita passage, which means it is not a strictly halakhic source, but nevertheless, this has served as a touchstone for much of this discussion, and that is a passage in Bava Kamma. In the end of Sefer Shmuel, the stories of the narrative of King David. So there's some very relatively obscure, but some very interesting discussions there. It basically lists the heroic feats accomplished by some of David's inner circle of heroes, his top generals, his top soldiers, great, mighty feats of bravery and courage and military prowess that they displayed. So one particular story, the Talmud says that David HaMelech was out campaigning somewhere. King David said there was a certain spring of delicious water. It was behind enemy lines, behind the Plishti lines. And he said, I wish I could have, oh, how I long for some water from that spring. So three of David's heroes, they leaped into action, they went on some kind of commando raid, they broke through the enemy lines, they got some water, they brought it back, and that's the story. Now, obviously, there's pshat, there's the literal interpretation of that story, but the Talmud wants to have something a little more timeless, a little grander and more interesting to take out of the story. So the Talmud says that the story is allegorical. Water is often a stand-in for Torah. David had a halachic question. David meant, I have a question which I deeply desire to know the answer to. This was before Twitter and before electronic communication. So this is like Civil War era stuff. If you had to pass a message to someone behind enemy lines, you needed a runner on a horse to do it. So three of Dabatero said, okay, we'll bring the Shiloh to the Sanhedrin, the supreme body arbiter of Jewish law. The Sanhedrin was behind enemy lines, so his heroes took the message to the Sanhedrin. They said, King David wants to know what is the halacha in such a case, and they brought back the answer. What was the halacha question that David was so anxious to know? Talmud has a few suggestions. One of them was, David was faced with the following ethical, legal, halachic dilemma in the laws of war. David had a question of military ethics, military law. He was hunting the Plishtim, the enemy. Plishtim were hiding, they were taking cover in fields. The fields were crops, were economically valuable crops. They belonged to Jewish citizens, Jewish farmers. David wanted to burn down the fields to exterminate the Plishtim, or to destroy their cover so he could exterminate them. He wanted to know, may I destroy private property in order to destroy the enemy? He sent the Sanhedrin. The answer was, it is prohibited to save yourself by the destruction of property belonging to somebody else. However, it's okay for you because the king, the government, has special dispensations. The king has special rules, Melech Paritz Geder, so actually it was okay. But the general rule was that it is prohibited to save yourself via the destruction of private property.
Does it make any difference as the Plishtim from whom you're stealing, or if it's a Yisrael? Or
yeah, so in this case, the crops belong, the Talmud says, to Jews. The Plishtim were hiding in Jewish fields.
Okay, I see.
So the language of the Talmud, it is prohibited to save yourself by the destruction of property belonging to someone else. Many, perhaps most authorities, they say it doesn't mean prohibited. It means that you can do it, but you're accountable. You can do it in an accountable way. You have to commit yourself to pay. You don't have the money, you'll pay when you do have the money, but you can't just take it with impunity. You do have to keep records and pay it back when you can. The fact that you're doing it to save your life is not a dispensation to simply take someone else's property. You do what you need to do, and you pay it back later. There is an opinion, minority opinion, that says usur means usur, prohibited means prohibited. You are not allowed to steal to save your life, full stop, no how, no way. The rule we said before, that the private property is sacrosanct even in a situation of life and death. And that is essentially the core of Rabbi Ettlinger's position. He says, when it comes to Benadim L'Chavera, when it comes to infringing on someone else's rights, you have no right to do it. And even, he says, according to the more normative opinion, that you do and pay back. In his case, if an autopsy, he says, you can never, this defiling of the dignity of the person after he's dead, you can never make it up to him, so to speak. He's dead. You can't compensate him for the intangible loss of his dignity. Again, some of these things we might have a hard time relating to. We may not place the same premium on our dignity that he did, but the basic rule, he says, is that in general it is prohibited to destroy property, or certainly dignity, even if necessary to save your own life. His position, again, is quite controversial. Rabbi Feinstein, again, has vehement criticism of it and says it's completely untenable. But it's not quite, there were others. The position does have some traction. There were a number of later authorities who felt that this is not a wholly unreasonable position, despite the fact that I have a duty to save, and I generally do have a duty to even spend money. I even have to spend money to save you. Despite that fact, you have no right to unilaterally seize property to save a life. Private property, other people's private rights are sacrosanct, and you have no right to do it. There is one of the most interesting cases in the responsa literature I've ever read. Occurs about 400 years ago, 500 years ago, in mid to late 16th century. There were a handful of Jewish merchants who were shipping merchandise through the waterways of Venice. Pirates came, sacked their ships, took the merchants and their merchandise, took it captive. The Venetian government, the Venetian Republic, sent out their anti-pirate force to strike against the pirates. They hit them. They seized a bunch of pirates, but the rest of the gang got away, and the property and the prisoners were not recovered. So they sat down to negotiate. The Venetians said, we'll give you back your pirate friends if you give us back our citizens and our property. The pirates were apparently men of honor, at least they claimed to be. They said, okay, deal. You give us back our pirate friends, we'll give you back your people. However, the property's not on the table. They claimed they didn't have it. They had sold it off, fenced it, eaten it, whatever it was. Property's not part of the deal. We'll do people for people. You're not getting back the property. So the government, the Venetians, they turned to the Jews and they said, here's the best deal we could negotiate. Take it or leave it. You want us to sign, you want us to do this, give up our leverage, give them back their pirates, you'll come back, but you'll have no hope of getting back your money. Or no, you want us to hold out and put more pressure on them in the hope of recovering the property. All the Jews who were captured were not too excited about remaining in the pirate dungeon, said, okay, sure, no problem. We want to get out of here, we'll give up the property. There was one Jew who was not on the ill-fated voyage, but his property was, and he said, nothing doing, not signing off. I want to keep twisting their arms. I want the money back. And the Venetians apparently weren't going to do it unless he signed off on it. So this case went to Rabbi Shmuel di Medina, the Marashtam, a leading Turkish Sephardic authority at the time. They asked him, what is the halacha? Now again, he probably didn't mean that he probably would have been perfectly happy, this merchant, if the other merchants would have indemnified him for his loss, if they would have made up his property, he would have no problem. He wasn't attached to the specific merchandise. He just meant, his argument was, why do I have to suffer? Why should I give up my money? Because you have a problem. You are tired of being in the pirate dungeon. That's your problem, not mine. You want me to spend my money on getting you out. You want me to waive my claim, give up my leverage against the pirates. Not my responsibility. Marashtam actually sides initially with this particular fellow. He says that he's within his rights. The halacha is Asir l'hatlas mamon chavero. They have no right to expect him to sacrifice his money for their problems. If they want to do that, let them pay him for it. Maybe he'll have to do it, and if they can't afford it, maybe he has to lay out the money. But if they can afford it, let him bill them. If they want him to waive his property rights to save their lives, he has to do it, but he has the right to charge. So that was his initial holding, that he would have the right to say, you want me to sign, pay me for it. His conclusion is, though, in line with what we would probably have assumed, that he does have to sign and he cannot demand payment. The argument he invokes is a complex and subtle one. It basically invokes the halakhic principle of rodef, the pursuer. He argues that his property is considered a rodef because it's the one causing them to be in jail, so the property is forfeit. That's a topic beyond the scope of today's talk. But in general, he says that his initial reaction was, Osir l'hatlas mamon chavero, you can't force somebody to give up his property to save you. Or maybe you can, but you have to pay him for it at the very least. There is a similar ruling that we find in a contemporary...
Here where the person is there, so can he be compelled for Osamu l'adam riacha?
So that is a very important point. We've been dancing around the question of how to reconcile these two things. On the one hand, there's a pretty strong consensus, almost everyone agrees, that you do have to spend money. If you're faced with the need to spend your money to save somebody's life, you do have to do it, and bill or not bill, but you have to do it. On the other hand, Rabbi Edlinger and others are claiming that I have no right to take your money to do it. So what if you're there? Can I just tell you, maybe I can't take it, but you're here and you have a mitzvah to do it. So there are indeed some authorities who distinguish between the case where the owner of the property is here, in which case he has an obligation to rescue, and therefore I can force him to give me the money, or if he doesn't, just take it against his will. And the case where he's not physically present, and since he's not here, the mitzvah doesn't devolve upon him because he's not here, and then I have no right to take it. Some make this distinction, some don't. That is a very tricky and important question, but yes, but potentially how to reconcile his duty with my right that I may not have is a tricky problem. It's a good question. The halacha generally, the question is whether in the case of the pirates their lives were in danger or they would just, their liberty was injured. Halacha generally assumes that being in captivity is tantamount to life, to danger to life. The Talmud says that pidyon shvuyim is the greatest need, even more than people whose lives are in danger, because it includes danger to life. Obviously, we can distinguish between cases, but there's a general presumption, which I think he is working with, that it was considered a matter of life and death, and still he initially ruled that way. A similar ruling we have, another Turkish authority from the same time, the Binyamin Zaev, he talked about a case of a fellow had property in security in his home or warehouse, and armed robbers broke in to steal his own property, the property that he had in security. They were going to empty out the warehouse, and he came upon them as they were committing the crime, and they told him, you make a sound, we'll cut your throats. So he kept quiet. He was then sued by the owner of the property for negligence as a shomer, as a bailey, that you let them steal it. He says, well, what do you want me to do? They were armed. He says, well, you could have called out, and the police, the watch would have come. So he said, they said they would kill me if I did that. He said, okay, you saved your life, at the expense of my property. So I expect you to pay for the property. Yes, you have to do it, maybe. There's no choice. And the Binyamin Zeev actually invokes this logic. He says there are certain technical details that the case hinges on, but in principle, he says, yes, that is the halacha, that if he, not saying he did the wrong thing, but if he saved his life by allowing someone else's property to be destroyed, he may very well be liable for that, due to the principle of Asul Hatzlatzmo, the Mamon Chaver. So this is the basic rule. You do have an obligation to save. It may even include spending money. However, whether someone else can unilaterally take property, that is a matter of considerable debate. There is one other halacha we should spend a few minutes discussing. The Talmud talks about a case of a Good Samaritan. Again, so in U.S. law, we have Good Samaritan laws, which are generally understood to be laws that provide for shields, exemptions from liability, if you step in to rescue a third party from harm. Good Samaritan is actually a New Testament thing, but in the law, that's what they call it. Halacha in the Talmud has a very similar rule. The Talmud says that if you, the victim, you're running from an enemy, and you destroy property in order to save your life, you steal someone's car and crash through a thing to get away from the pursuer, you are liable, as we said before. The rule is if you save your own life at the expense of someone's property, it might be mutter, but you have to pay for it. What if a third party destroys property in order to save someone else? I see someone being chased. I step in and I steal someone else's car to help him escape. And I'm not in any danger. I steal someone else's car to help him escape, and I damage the car in the process. So I am exempt. The Talmud says, in principle, I should be liable too, because, again, even if there's a mitzvah to save lives, it doesn't absolve anyone from responsibility for property damage that they cause. However, we have a takana, we have a rabbinic institution, essentially a Good Samaritan law. We don't want to disincentivize people from coming to the aid of people in danger of their lives. So we have a takana that someone who steps in like that is exempt for what he did. There's actually some discussion, going back to the case of King David, why couldn't he claim that same exemption? Some say because that was very early times, before this rule had been passed. Some say that because King David and his men were in danger themselves, they didn't need to be incentivized, even if they were saving the Jewish people as a whole. They themselves were in danger from the Plishtim enemies, so in a case where you're in danger too, you can claim the special takana. But in a classic case where you are in no danger at all, and you simply step in to save a third party from harm, and you cause damage, then you're exempt from compensating for the damage that you've done. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. Again, he was asked by the Baba of a Rebbe, who had a Hasidic master who had borrowed money during the Holocaust to engage in rescue activities, and subsequently after the war, those loans came due. The Rebbe had argued that he did plan on paying them back, but he held that it was simply out of the goodness of his heart, he would try to pay them back. He held that according to strict halacha, he had no responsibility to pay them back. The money he had borrowed was purely for the sake of saving third parties whose lives were in danger. As such, he felt that he would have the rescuer's exemption from paying back such monies. Rabbi Feinstein has a very sharp limitation of the rescuer's exemption. He says it only applies to, let's say, an ambulance driver who, in the course of pursuit, or in the course of running away, accidentally causes harm, causes a damage, a tort. That's when there's an exemption from accidental damage that you cause while you're saving somebody. It does not apply to a deliberate obligation that you assume on yourself, even if that's for the noblest of purposes. He therefore told the Rebbe that he actually is liable for this. This is actually the subject of a debate among earlier authorities. There was a case in the 15th century where there was a city that was beset by enemies, by by thieves, or by armed robbers of some sort. And there was a local militia formed to fight off the enemy. And the militia, at least some of them, failed and were taken by the enemy, who stripped them of their arms and armor. Some of the arms and armor had been borrowed. So once again, we have this kind of case where the owner of the weapons sued the militiamen for the return of the property. And the question is, yes, you were doing it for a noble reason, to save lives, maybe even the life of the person who had the armor, but in any event, he said, you know, saving lives is noble, but it doesn't exempt you from liability for what you've done. And the question again arose whether we have the rescuer's exemption. Poskim went back and forth on this. Some said that they didn't have any exemption because since they were in danger too, there's no need to incentivize them. Others said they did have the exemption despite the fact that this was borrowed property that they had contractual responsibilities for. So there is a lot of debate about exactly how far this goes. I included here in the handouts at the end an interesting paper about 20, 30 years ago by Rabbi Mark Dretsch. He talked about a case of someone who could not get life-saving medicine and wanted to know if he could steal the medicine to save someone's life. He discusses all these factors we've been discussing. On the one hand, there's a duty to save, which, according to most authorities, even overrides theft or any prohibition. You actually can steal it. On the other hand, generally, if you steal, you're liable to pay it back, whether it's for your own life or for a third party's life. In this case, he was taking the medicine for his wife, but you do have a responsibility to pay it back. Yet, we have the rescuer's exemption, which he does seem to apply. He does feel should apply in this case, should be applied broadly any time. Again, the question is, if it's you and your wife, should we consider you like one unit and say it's as if you stole it for yourself? It's an interesting point, but beyond that, he basically does apply the rescuer's exemption to such cases. Close with one last discussion. Various contemporary poskim have different forms of this case, but it actually goes back apparently to an earlier case, 19th century, even earlier cases. If someone threatens to destroy himself if you do not rob a bank to get him some money, or maybe not quite so dramatic, but someone is in desperate need of something and he tells you that I'm going to commit suicide unless you commit some sin.